I'm about to deliver. Good morning. I'm home. It's so good to be home. I love going away, but I join Reverend Clyde in just that great rejoicing of returning to the place where you once began and seeing it for the first time and just loving to sleep in your own bed with your own pillow and all this stuff that goes along with that. And I love being here with you. And you know, I've been sitting still for a couple of weeks, and sometimes it's almost a little dangerous to let a minister sit still. And I've done a lot of reading and in that spaciousness, I've had a lot of time to think about all this stuff I've been working on for this past year and the ways in which I have noticed myself, how my message is changing and developing, and that there seems to be something, I've said it for so long, that something is so trying to emerge on this planet, and we are ripe with possibility right now. And so I want to speak to you from my heart today about some of the things that I have decided are important to me, and the way some of my ideas are starting to reorder themselves. And I love this teaching. So welcome to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living, and I am Reverend Karen Rice. If I neglected to say that, you should know that. I have this interesting topic that I've taken from a book by an old religious science minister. The book was written in 1957. Dr. Frederick Bales. I'm never sure if his name is Bales or Bayless, because we knew people who pronounced that Bayless. So if I say both names, just go with it. It'll be okay. And he wrote this book called Hidden Power for Human Problems. And it's one of those wonderful books that's kind of a classic that's been around a long time. And if you think about the early days of religious science, Dr. Ernest Holmes, the founder who created the sort of methodology from studying all the great universal truths, spiritual truths, philosophies, and all of that, packaged it up in this great synthesis that we now have as a model for living our lives. And it's a universal model that anybody could use. You don't have to, you know, we don't need to convert people to our religious faith. We certainly would love to fill the house. That would make me really excited to fill the house, because our message is so exciting. And I think that I'm going to augment what I always say with a little more oomph than I perhaps otherwise would have, had I not just come back from vacation. So Dr. Bayless had this idea that is sort of uniquely his. That was very cool that you found a quote from something so current as the Chopra Center on the idea of the master thoughts. And the master thought is the God thought. And he uses this idea throughout the whole book that we have parent thoughts, and then there's the master thought. And the parent thought is the thought that pops through our little mind based on our experiences and how we were raised and what our parents believed and what the consensus of the human race believes. So they're not necessarily our own beliefs, but somehow they're embedded in us already. Ernest Holmes called it, and as well as many of the other great classic metaphysicians, they spoke of it as a race thought. In other words, the combined thought of the human race. Carl Jung would have referred to it as the collective unconscious. So there's that unconscious stuff that lives in us, and Dr. Bayless had this idea that was unique to him, that we each and every one of us have at least 6 to 8 hidden primary beliefs that we don't even know we have. And maybe they're not even ours. If somebody pointed them out to you, you might even argue about it. But that's what the whole point of the spiritual journey is to uncover those hidden beliefs that really feed your thoughts. And then what we know is what we think about is what we then create in terms of the experiences and the conditions of our own life. As you believe, it is done unto you, Jesus said. So we're going to look today at this idea of how to get back to the master thought and some of the changes that we can recognize that have unfolded, not just since Dr. Frederick was writing books in the 1950s, and by the way, he would have been, because he was a religious science minister in the 1950s, he was likely appointed to be a minister by Dr. Ernest Holmes. That was how it all started in the early days. Before we had seminary and more formal training. So I noticed the date is this is the last Sunday in August. It's August 27th. Honey, you know what that means? Granddaughter Tori's birthday. It just flipped through my mind. I'm going to say it out loud so you can back me up and make sure we do something about that later. August 27th, the last Sunday in August, and so we're wrapping up the monthly theme. CSL has this beautiful, my goodness, I have so much respect for our organization, this beautiful year-long theme, as Reverend Clyde was speaking to, of the values-based spiritual living, and for the month of August, we have focused on love, compassion, and caring as a way we show up in our spiritual living. So spiritual living through love, compassion, and caring. And as I was thinking about that from my well-rested perspective, it occurred to me that I have changed some of the ways in which I have thought for all my years of participating actively in my own spiritual life, my own well-being. And what I realized was there was a time, and I think I've been delivering this in my messages all year long, maybe the last 18 months or so, I would guess, that there's something different in my perspective, personally, in which I see, I no longer read a statement that says, an affirmation that says, spiritual living through compassion and love and caring, I no longer hear that as something I should be doing or that I need to be doing better. And so as I played with that idea, I thought, wouldn't it be lovely if the next lesson for us then, as we begin to accept that we do the best we can, it is sometimes the very act of not showing up in the highest way that we could that gets our attention and makes us make a firm intention or have a conviction for never making that mistake again, right? So what if all of that was okay? And that made me think that, you know what I think we need to do is we need to take the ER off of a whole bunch of words. So I notice in my old, when I do my, a couple times a year, I do a be, have, do list. I learned that in ministerial school. Be, have, do. You write 100 things. Be, have, do. No special order. You just let it randomly pour out of you so you can get a look at your own values and where you are on any given day. And I realized as I looked at some of my past lists, I would have written things like be kinder, be more loving. And see, I wouldn't do that now. Now, when I did my, while I was away, I did my be, do, have list, and I saw that what I wrote was, be kind, be loving. Nowhere on my list would it ever say, be better, because I'm finally having enough self-compassion to acknowledge that I'm really doing the best I can, and it does not serve anybody when I keep trying to do better and better as if I'm going to outdo myself, or as if there's some goal I need to achieve, or as if there's some fear of displeasing God Almighty, and that is not how I want to live my life anymore. Yeah. So you'll join me on dropping the ERs? I think it's brilliant. I do. I think it's brilliant. So I wanted to say that because when I started to play with that, I thought, you know, that what if that was the only thing, the only tidbit, it's two letters. What if that was the only tidbit of wisdom we ever needed? Because if we got that, I think we would show up in our life and we would quit trying so hard to do the right thing, to say the right words to the people we love when they're going through something difficult, and we would then be able to stand up in this gorgeous integrity and our own authenticity, and we could allow people in front of us to be vulnerable, people to be sad, and we could just be this beautiful presence, this really clear, gorgeous presence where it would be safe for somebody to be vulnerable in front of us. How does that sound? Yeah, and it relieves us from that whole need to fix somebody or cheer somebody up when they're down. And it puts us in this pure and beautiful, beautiful place of being a presence. Wow. This is exciting because it is simple. And at times, I don't think it is simple. I think we have so much pressure on ourselves to be the right kind of presence. But I think it's about availability. It's about being real in the present moment. And just, you know, when you're with people, be with people. Put the freaking phone away. You know, I noticed that I've developed a good habit that when I'm sitting with somebody and my phone does something and I look down to make sure it's not urgent, I'm becoming more and more aware of when I do that, and I'm turning it upside down so I can't even see it blink. I keep the sound off and I turn it upside down so I don't even see it blink until I'm done with whoever's in front of me in that moment. And I'm really trying to honor that because I think that's what this is all about. When we begin to look at life from this perspective, what I think I see happening is that this idea of being present and practicing the presence, which is a spiritual term we use sometimes, it's sort of a challenge to our own, try and hear this with an open mind, but it's a challenge to our own moral responsibility to the world, to each other, to some kind of integrity we can have in relationship with each other, which is indeed our relationship to something much larger than just something else. And in that way, we really are creating more compassion, more love, more caring, and all of that, but it's very organic. It just is gonna happen. So, there's been a lot going on in the world for a while. Probably forever, you know how that goes. But I've been noticing this last 12 to 18 months, as I'm observing my own changes, some of that is in the way that I observe you changing. And the way that we have walked through some chaos and some, with a great deal of wonderment and a lot of question marks and not really knowing. But the gift of it has that it has called us to stand in principle, to stand in those things that don't change, to practice our spiritual teaching in a greater way. And what I realize is that this whole idea of be loving, be compassionate, be caring is almost humorous to me, in as much as I believe that we can't not be caring. We can't not be caring. Look at your own life. Look at your own life, and if you could do that gently and with a delicate review, look at the ways in which, in the last year, your own heart has gotten more tender. That the things that we all still have opinions about, because there are lots of sides or positions we could stand in based on all this stuff going on, notice that we may still have strong ideas about what we think it should look like, but what's happening is we can't help but feel our hearts ache in a sort of unique way and in a much broader sort of coverage of life. You know, I can no longer see a dog loose on the street and just not feel there, something needs to be done about that, right? There was a time where I could go by and go, oh, I hope that little creature gets, you know, oh. But now you can't do that anymore. It's like we're all waking up in a different way. So I'm seeing some kind of tenderness that is really, if you're me, it's quite beautiful. But what I want to say is you can see it too. I think that we are thinking. We have been pulled to a position of being more discerning. We recognize we really do want to stand in a greater space of love and compassion and we really are, like everybody else, trying to figure out what's going on and what we should do next and what we should say where and all of that. So what appears, this is important, what appears to be a great amount of chaos or a huge and rather loud argument, you know, there are different sides to this sort of big argument, all globally, I would say. What I'm suggesting today is that there is a way that as we continue to wake up, especially together as a spiritual community, as we do that, I believe there is a way to see the shiny side in all of this. And I am not talking about positive thinking here. I'm talking about standing in principle, which I will elaborate on in a minute. And I'm talking about looking in a broader way of all the things going on in the world and all the things that have ever gone on in the world, and to observe that the friction of us bumping up against different ideas and different ways of doing things and different thoughts, whether they're a parent thought or a master thought, doesn't matter. As we start to bump up against each other, it smooths out our rough edges. See, I just came back from my most favorite place. Most of you, anybody who knows me will know this, but Hugh and I have a favorite little beach on the Central Coast. We've been going for 100 years. We've been going to the same place. And boy, some things are, it was interesting to see that I had some of the opinions about some of the changes I observed there. It was like I had to go right back to prayer. It's okay, change is not a bad thing. But there's a way that right on Moonstone Beach, it's like a quarter of a mile, this little bitty strip of beach, and it's never crowded with people. And there's a stream, a creek that kind of rushes like a river in the heavy rains that brings these rocks out of the canyon, and they tumble all the way down from the mountains, and then they get out to sea, and when they hit where the waves, when the tide comes up and the waves wash over them, you can hear them. Oh, it's extraordinary to just listen to the wave come, and as the wave pulls back out, it tumbles those rocks, and it's loud, and it's exciting, it's powerful. And then when the tide goes further out, you can go sit in a pile of rocks. You can walk on them because they're so smooth, you can walk barefoot on the stones and they feel fabulous to the bottom of your feet. And then I sit there and I can sit for hours just handling these beautifully polished stones. God did it. Nobody's put them in a tumbler. It's the tumbler of life, right? And science has a name for that. Science calls it when nature changes things gradually over time, they call that lysis, L-Y-S-I-S. And in the scientific worldview, or if you look at geology, you would see that nature itself changes things either slowly and gradually over time, or a crisis can come and change the shape of a coastline. Right? We know there are disasters that happen that change things exactly in a moment, and it'll never look the way it did before. So the lesson for us, the spiritual lesson in that, is that we're going to change anyhow, and we are changed either by crisis or by lysis. We can support the idea that the problems we encounter in our experiences in life are the very things that are polishing us up. right? They're very things we need to be shiny and to be pretty and to be attractive. You know, I'm drawn to those stones because they're so gorgeous. So when we are moving through a challenge in our life and we have the courageous audacity to be vulnerable, to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to experience sadness, to experience frustration or disappointments or fear, whatever it is, we are being processed by this thing called life in a gorgeous way. And so what I think is happening is that we collectively, whether we can acknowledge it or not yet, I believe that we, and what I'm observing, and I'm going to stand strong in this truth. Do I need to say more? That's pretty good. Oh, I'm going to leave it right here because he's going to need it. You can put it right here, Rod. It'll be fine. Well, maybe. So as I stand in that, what I think is happening, and I'm really inviting you to just join me in playing with the possibility that maybe it could be real. Maybe the minister could be right. I think what we are doing as we move through this lysis, this change in humanity, watching what is trying to observe that's creating something better and better, because that's what life does, that we're creating a field, a different energetic field that is inviting us to have a whole different idea of what forgiveness is, that is inviting us to understand acceptance and inclusivity in new and powerful ways that we've never even considered before. I think that the way we are dealing with differences is smoothing off those coarse, sharp, rough edges, even though it doesn't look good or sound pretty, and maybe you've even given up Facebook for a while, except Mark, who's praying right now, so it'll be okay, that we are really creating a way for us to shine as we courageously just keep moving with the gradual changes. Rumi, it reminded me of that wonderful Rumi quote. I had to look it up this morning. Beyond right thinking and wrong thinking, there is a field. Meet me there. See, I think we're creating that field with our intention, with our willingness to be devoted to spiritual practice. Being a spiritually evolved person or being enlightened, however you want to look at whatever that great goal might be in your book of understanding, it doesn't mean we aren't going to have human experiences. And that's okay. And that's always my message. That's always what I feel compelled to speak about again and again. Because the thing is, we are adaptable. The universe is adaptable, and we as human beings have adapted tremendously through the years. I noticed, I'll tell you one thing, the more chaotic the world got this past 12, 18 months, the more I devoted myself to creating more order in my home and in my person. The more determined I was to stand in spiritual truth and know the master thought and not be bullied around by the experiences in life that frighten me. So, this is a good thing. We have a method. We have a teaching. We offer practical skills for living our lives, for applying spiritual principles. And Emma Curtis Hopkins called it the Jesus Christ method. And Joel Goldsmith called it the infinite way. Brené Brown is calling it the rising strong. Rising strong, this gorgeous woman who writes and teaches about vulnerability is becoming famous on a book called Rising Strong. We call it sometimes here, you hear terms like mental science or practical spirituality. We call it new thought, but here's what I want to tell you. There is a thought movement. I'm just going to call it a thought movement. We have, I notice Oprah calls the people she interviews, she calls them thought leaders. And now there's a whole thing on thought leaders, how to become a thought leader. What's your unique message for the world? How do you impact the world in a positive way? What direction do you want to go? And what I'm saying is, I believe that this is a time where we are living in a thought movement. I love that passage from Romans that I keep on the wall here. Be transformed by what? By renewing your mind, by thinking, by being involved in your thinking. And then René Descartes, this French philosopher, comes along and he says, I think, therefore I am. Right? Thinking. Ernest Holmes says, became known for, or he coined the phrase, change your thinking, change your life. Right? So it's about this kind of think. I think we're thinking. And that's why I see such tremendous hope for everything that seems to be a little crazy and chaotic. More people than ever before. So interesting how often I hear this now, are following the words of the Dalai Lama. My religion is kindness. Wow. What kind of great spiritual principle is that to stand on? That's a beautiful, beautiful gift. So what's happening is we're developing better discernment. We're encouraging thinking. All of the self-help books are now spilling into spiritual ideas and vice versa. And even the business section now, when I go to Barnes & Noble, I have to walk down the business section and look at the leadership books because they are filled with spiritual wisdom now. It's everywhere. You cannot not see it if you keep your eyes open. So here's what I want to talk about now. This is important, and I from time to time I think it's necessary to bring it up, and it fits so good with what I'm saying. So there is this idea of, as I said earlier, of what Holmes called the race consciousness. Jung would have called it the collective unconscious. And it's this idea that, and all the great psychologists and the studies they're doing on the brain, they all say the same thing that the philosophers have been saying forever, that the human mind, for some reason, has a stronger attraction to the negative things, that we hold in our memories the difficult times, and we notice more of the, we notice more bad than good. And it's just, it probably comes from the fight and flight. Did I say that right? Fight and flight. You know, the dinosaur days, or the woolly mammoth is going to, you got to kill him if you're going to eat, right? Whatever. I'm moving on. my mind just went in some interesting places. So it's just reminiscent of that, because that is part of the collective consciousness or unconsciousness. It's in us somewhere. It remains. It guides us and it protects us in many ways. But the thing about race thought or that collective unconscious is that there's this unspoken consensus that happens in the world. Money's hard to get, or money's hard to keep. Ooh, the flu's going around. Oh, I bet I'm going to get the flu. All the things that are in our life that really are not even our beliefs, but we got to live with all this stuff. So Ernest Holmes had a lot to say about it. This is a little dictionary that he originally published in 1942. And I looked up race belief and race mind. So he's not talking about racial ethnicity or racial issues. We're talking about the human race, all of humanity. Race belief has a tendency to repeat. Thought patterns formed by the consensus of human opinion automatically operate through everyone. Everyone. No, you can't get so enlightened you don't have a race thought now and then. Unless you consciously reject the thought. Well, there is the path. You don't like what you're thinking, notice it. That's why that's one of the first things we do is we talk to you a lot about paying attention to what kind of thoughts are moving through your mind so you can reject the thoughts that don't fit, that you don't really align to or believe in or want to believe in. He goes on to say that living in accord with the law of averages, race belief is living in accord with the law of averages, in accord with what the average person experiences. Now, we've had this talk before. Do you want to be average? Oh, hell no! There's no children in the room, right? Oops, sorry, David. No, we do not want to be average. So the race mind, Holmes says, is the sum total of all human belief throughout the ages, the collective unconscious. Race belief, race suggestion, all of that it clumps all together. So sometimes Ernest Holmes called it the seat of memory. So every thought that has ever been thought before is still sort of lingering around. The real question, the only one that concerns me, is what of those beliefs are embedded within me? If there are 6 to 8, it's just a theory. It doesn't mean it's real, but it's something to think about. If, Dr. Bale says, if we each have 6 to 8 hidden thoughts that we don't even know exist, what's going on in me? What kind of conditions am I still creating in my life that aren't even mine, that I could reject the thought and make a different choice and plant a different kind of seed. So we're in this place where there's sort of this, if you look at the idea of good and bad, it's almost in terms of the consensus of the average person, it's lopsided. There's a polarity of good and bad that we can see, we can measure, we can contrast, but it's lopsided. It's heavy on the bad end because human perception tends to see the negative before the positive. And that's why we talk about this every week, so that we can leave here, so that even before you leave here, you will look in someone's eyes and recognize beauty today. And then when you're driving home, you will see something magnificent, some part of creation that you've never even noticed before, because something will have stirred within you while you've sat here this morning. So there are all these fabulous theories, and the big point is it doesn't matter what's happened to you all your life. It doesn't matter what your family history has been. That yes, that memory may be embedded in a cellular way, it lingers in us, but what matters is what we choose to notice right now. What matters is thinking to go back to the master thought. You know what the master thought is? The God thought. It's the one mind. It's the highest thought there is, and it is always, always there and active in our lives. Dr. Bales says in Hidden Power for Human Problems, he says this, although a child is not born into the world fear-ridden, he carries in the lower depths of his mind the unconscious memory of all the buried experiences of his ancestors. These form, here's where it gets interesting, think about this, those buried memories form the fertile soil in which our own personal experiences take root, and this becomes the mold for our future. Oh, it's kind of long. I'll make sure it's on the internet for you. So a child is not born into the world fear-based, right? Kids have a couple things they're afraid of, falling and loud noises, I think, is the other one. So, but we don't, the fears that we have now, we have enhanced through our experience and through that unconscious memory. So we carry that memory in the lower depths of our mind, the unconscious memory of all the buried experiences of our ancestors, and then those beliefs form the soil in which our personal experiences take root. It's like, oh, I knew that would happen, right? No, say no, that's not right. It didn't have to happen. Or you can change it in a minute if you go, oh, I knew that would happen. Okay, what can I do now to go in a different direction? How can I choose again, choose differently? And that becomes then the mold in which our future is cast. So we're setting the mold all the time. And that's why we have such gorgeous testimonies in New Thought, because we start to change the mold. I mean, I look around this room and I will tell you that there are people here who do not even look like the people they were when I first met them 6 years ago. Because we start to make change, and we change in every way. And so there's this cycle of life that demands that to be true. There's this cycle of life. There's this way that the seed you put in the ground makes a little plant, and the plant creates a beautiful flower, a flower blooms. Think about the wildflowers we see in the desert. You know, nobody, we don't do that. Right? But the flower blooms, and then when the flower is ripe and almost done, what happens? The wind comes and it releases its seed that then starts the blooms for the next season. But what happens to the little flower? It wilts away and it dies and it becomes the compost. It fertilizes the next batch of what's going to come. It's the parent thought that's embedded in there, the hidden thought that we don't know about. The parent thought is always giving birth. It's always creating the next experience. And our freedom lies in recognizing that, wait a minute, that's a parent thought, but there's a master thought that's bigger and more powerful, and it's right here waiting for me to notice. At any given moment, I can change my entire life. So there's this cycle. There's this way. It's the law of circulation. It's the law of correspondence. It's the reciprocal action of the universe. I don't care what you call it. There is a way that we have as human beings. We have an in-breath and we have an out-breath. We have to have that, right? There has to be that rhythm. But more than that, we have to breathe in oxygen. And when we exhale, we're breathing out carbon dioxide, and the trees can't live without the carbon dioxide, and the trees give us the oxygen. So we are in this dependent relationship that is one, that we are all here connected together, the in-breath and the out-breath, the cycle of life, the cause of life itself. Dr. Bales also said, the law always responds to us. This is the one that's going to have the kick in the on the other end of it here. The law always responds to us. There's no mystery about this. I love that. The law always responds. There's no mystery about this. Everyone here knows that. But this law is completely impersonal. It is not affected by how needy we are, how much we plead with God to bring this miraculous whatever it is in our life. No matter how much we bargain or make promises to reform our life because we somehow think we aren't worthy enough. Can you see how it's been so upside down forever and always? And then here we come, new thinkers, and we go, oh no, no, what if there's another way? What if, simply by my thought, there's another way? So there's no mystery about it, and it's not the law doesn't care how much we need something. The law responds to one thing alone, that is compliance with principle. So we teach principle here. We teach how the law works. We start by looking at gravity. It just works. We might not be able to figure out all the whys. It doesn't even matter. But your ignorance to the way spiritual laws work does not save you from the consequence. So our hope is in returning to the master thought, being responsible for the choices we make, thinking, for us to think. It's the greatest gift of all. Dr. Bales had this gorgeous, I just wanted to give you this freebie to take home today because it's so good. When something would go wrong in his life, he would catch himself worrying about something that he didn't really need to be worrying about. He had this affirmation that he always said, Oh, recognize the thought. I'm really glad this is in God's hands. I'm glad that God is taking care of this. Isn't that lovely? Right? That means when I align myself to the master thought and I know the truth about a power and a presence is greater than I am, and I walk in that pattern, I am no longer average. And I will rise above the average experience, and we will consequently, by nature of the law, experience more and more good in our lives. It is a big wow. It's a big wow. I know there's scary stuff going on in the world. I'm not naive. I'm picky about how I get my news. I will confess that. But what tickles me is more and more people now, and this I would say is new in the last year, to 12 to 18 months, more and more people are being choosy about where they get their news. We didn't used to have that conversation. We've had that one now. But here's the good news. This is why I came today, because I had to say this to you. This is so amazing. I read this fabulous book, something about religious rebels in America or something like that. It was just an amazing read. It was very fun. And so I have all these new things that are percolating in me. Every generation, probably from the beginning of time, has produced religious rebels. Every generation, we know that because there are so many religions. How come we have so many religions? Because somebody rebels and goes, no, we shouldn't be doing it that way anymore. So I love looking at that idea. History shows us that religious dissatisfaction is the very thing that brings rise to new forms of worship, of spirituality. Religious dissatisfaction. So the Puritans come to the New World. Why did the Puritans come to the New World? Well, they wanted freedom. They wanted to do things their way. They didn't want to be so yoked by the Church of England. How courageous was it to get on a little boat and sail across the ocean to stand up for your freedom, for your religious freedom? So the Puritans come to America for religious freedom, and interestingly, they never had any intention of granting religious freedom to anybody else. Right? Because that's the way that works. And so for about 100 years, they did the best they could. And after about 100 years, something started to change. People started thinking more and questioning, and other little religions started outnumbering the Puritans, and more people were immigrating to the New World. And people began to question and to think and to open their minds and to query these great things. But in 1692, do you know what happened in 1692? The witch trials. The witch hunts happened in 1692. What a devastating experience that must have been to be anybody witnessing any of that stuff that went absolutely sideways. And talk about rough edges and a scary time to belong to that tribe. But here's what I noticed in the book. This wasn't in the book, but I made a timeline as I was studying all this stuff. And what I saw was that 40 years after the witch hunts, only 40 years, in the 1730s, it was considered a time of great awakening. Now, interesting number 40, right? 40 years in the desert and all that. 40 as a symbol of the end of a generational mentality. 40 years within, there were people still alive. And suddenly, the Puritan code is no longer valued. Puritan ideas are being negated. More and more people are leaving those ideas. And do you know why they left? I'm going to say, I didn't read it, I'm just making it up, you know me. They left because of the witch hunts, because they witnessed horrifying things and they said, that's enough. That can never happen again. Not in my lifetime can that ever happen again. For only 40 years later, there was a massive change. And do you know what happened almost 40 years after that? So it's this, they're calling it the time of enlightenment. People are waking up and thinking, and now another 40 years goes by. 1776, what happened? Well, the U.S. Constitution happened. Benjamin Franklin had broad ideas. He was a great thinker. Thomas Jefferson, there was this look at deism, a whole different idea of living a spiritual life, so different than what the Puritans had brought over. Not only that, but John Locke and Isaac Newton had made these scientific discoveries where you could measure things and understand things and know stuff. And so they're thinking. You see what I've just done? I've gone full circle. They were thinking. They began to use rationality and to discern things and to stand in higher truths because they now had more information. By the year 1800, they called it, in 1800, they said it was the time of the Second Great Awakening. What I want to say to you today is that we are still awakening because it's what we do. It's what life does. It's why we are here. Change awakens thinking within us, and that gives us greater and greater possibilities. We learn, I want to say we learn from the witch hunts. We learn from our mistakes, and then we take a higher stand because we've smoothed out our coarseness, our roughness, and humanity is constantly being reshaped because there's this great evolvement of life itself. We see it in the planet. We can see it in our kids. We can see it in every new generation, how we adapt and we change. And so what I want to suggest today is that let us not be angry at our ancestors for those hidden beliefs. You know, that was the best they had then. It served a purpose. But let us be daring enough to re-examine what we believe and to play in that area where the hidden beliefs lie and to look at the choices we make and ask ourselves, am I living the life I desire to live? Because if we're not, take a class for God's sake. Come do something here. We won't try and cheer you up. We will give you a space to have conversation. We will point out the way the law works. We will talk about spiritual principle. My friends, I have to stop, and I don't want to stop. I have so much more to say, but my friends, we were born for times like these. This is not a time for us to shrivel and be afraid. This is a time where we are being pushed to be spiritually creative, to be religiously creative, to find that place. I'm going to start a new thing. We're going to all do this. We're going to find a way to create our own personal theology so we know what we believe and we can stand in our own truth, and then we can find that way that we can disagree with somebody else's view, but that we can totally honor. It's what we say every Sunday. It's in our vision statement. I want to close with a quote from Ernest Holmes that I have read many, many times from this platform because it's one of my favorite quotes, and I think it's so meaningful for life and this life that we're living in 2017. Nature will never let us stay in any one place for too long. She will let us stay just long enough to gather the experience necessary to the unfolding and the advancement of our soul. Nature demands change in order that we might advance. It's just change. Change is necessary, but we have a way. We can be glad that this is in the hands of God. And we can rejoice in knowing, in absolutely knowing, there is a power and a presence that is greater than we are, and we can use it. Take a breath. Take a holy breath. And we'll take some time to turn within and anchor these ideas in prayer. And so reflecting on everything that has been spoken this day. We open our hearts and our minds to grab that gem and to pull it within us, to embed it forever in our cellular memory. For there is a truth, there is a power, there is a presence, and it is love. And it is right here, right now, in this very room, and it abides at the core of every human being, every person sitting in a chair this day, those who are at the sound of my voice even now, in every blade of grass, in every beautiful passing cloud from the monsoon, the way life stirs itself up and then cleanses and then restores itself to a new place of normalcy. I feel the love of God. I feel it right here in the center of my being, and I know that it is that activity of life that is the very thing that motivates, that stirs us to desire those yearnings we feel for peace on earth, for peace and order in our lives. It is the way we can feel the depth of compassion in our hearts as we sit vulnerably with each other. God. That amazing presence of wisdom that allows us to sit in conversation and question what it is that we believe in this moment and why we are here and what is the world for. The delicious ponderings of life, it is a call from that urge within, it is the master thought. It is the divine imagination that is emerging even now on this planet, in this community, in this building, in ways we know and in ways we haven't even begun to imagine yet. So I know that there is a healing going on, that we are being restored to a sense of connection and wholeness and perfection and goodness, and that as we align ourselves to this divine pattern, as we wake up yet again, we choose what it is we desire to think. We call on the higher thoughts to relieve us of those things that we worry about or things that frighten us. And in that open posture, we become a vessel to receive the grace of God and to be glad that it is God that does the work. There is a law that is always working on our behalf, and I say thank you, God. We are so grateful for this awakening that is happening now, this great awakening on this planet where we dare to imagine and where we step confidently into that space of knowing that we are not the only ones. And so with the fullness of gratitude in my being, understanding that all limitations are removed, there is nothing that holds us back, that we can stand in compliance with the law and we can thrive and we can flourish and we can allow ourselves to bloom and to seed and to choose to replant ourselves again and again and again, for it is the givingness of God that this is so. The eternality of that circulation of life. And so in that place of deep, deep gratitude, I simply say, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, life. Thank you, infinite spirit, for this and for so much more. And I release these words into the law, and together we say, and so it is. Amen.